I'm reading from the book of Hebrews, chapter 12, verse 14 and 15. Pursue peace with everyone, and the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and through it many become defiled. And God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and infallible word.
We are continuing our journey through the Epistle to the Hebrews. And today we are spending most of our time exploring one small phrase that sits in the heart of the reading that you have heard in verse 15. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and through it many become defiled. The New Living Translation of verses 14 and 15 of Hebrews chapter 12 put it this way: work at living in peace with everyone, one, and work at living a holy life. For those who are not holy will not see the Lord. Look after each other so that none of you fails to receive the grace of God. Watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you, corrupting many. The Message, paraphrasing the same phrase, says this: keep a sharp eye out for weeds of bitter discontent. A thistle or two gone to seed can ruin a whole garden in no time. As we continue our journey through this majestic epistle, this Spirit-breathed message to a believing community under pressure, I want to remind you that it is not abstract theology. What we are not listening to is armchair doctrine or a spiritual pick-me-up. These letters, these words were addressed to a community that was being squeezed and marginalized and opposed, that was being tempted to withdraw from the faith, tempted to drift into irrelevance, or tempted to compromise what they believed. And the author is like a faithful pastor, writing to them to keep bringing them back to the central truth that is the title of actually this whole series: above all. Jesus is above all, above Moses, above angels, above Aaron, above the old covenant, above everything. Because Jesus is supreme, the community must endure, not only outwardly, inwardly. Because Jesus is supreme, they can endure, not only outwardly, but inwardly. Persecution doesn't only threaten faith. It threatens love between brother and sister. It threatens unity. And it threatens holiness. It threatens the emotional and the relational commitment of God's people to one another, not only to God. And it's into that context that Hebrews speaks one of the most searching sentences of the whole book, relationally, pastorally, and ethically. See to it that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and through it many become defiled. Verse 15 of Hebrews 12. This isn't a tiny little minor alarm. This is a clanging alarm bell. Because bitterness is not simply a private feeling. It is a community pollutant. And this afternoon, we're going to read Hebrews 12, verses 12 to 15, carefully. And we're going to set it in the flow of all of Hebrews 12. And see how this warning about bitterness is not disconnected from the above all supremacy of Jesus, but actually grounded in the example, the life, the ministry, and the witness of Jesus Christ. And I'm praying that the Holy Spirit will do what only the Holy Spirit can do. Not only transform us, but heal us. And speak into some areas of our lives where bitterness may be in danger of taking root. You've already heard the text read. So let's go through it line by line. But feel the flow first. Hebrews 12 begins with the great call to endurance. Verses 1 and 2. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter. Do you remember I talked about that with you a few weeks ago? Actually, those words are very difficult to translate. The starter, the finisher, the beginning, the end, the source and the destination of our faith. So the central image that Hebrews 12 is rooted in isn't a classroom, it's a race. And it's not a seminar, it's a marathon. Not only correcting beliefs, but strengthening enduring faith. And when the writer says, don't interpret suffering, and then the writer says, don't interpret suffering as abandonment. We looked at it, do you remember? It's fatherly discipline. It isn't punishment, it is training. He says God disciplines those he loves in verse 11. He's forming a people who can share in his holiness, and he is producing the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now that phrase is important. Peaceful fruit. Because the section we're in is going to talk about peace and holiness in the community. God, in other words, is training his people not just to survive persecution, but to become holy people who live holy lives together. And now the writer turns from interpretation to application. He's been saying, don't grow weary, don't lose heart, don't misread suffering, keep your eyes on the author and the perfecter of your faith, Jesus. And then he says, therefore, here are practical implications of what that looks like. So what we're reading this afternoon isn't disconnected moral advice. It's not every day with Jesus in Hebrews 12. It is deeply rooted in the choices that you and I make and in the context that we find ourselves in. It's the outworking of Christ-centered endurance. Sticking at it. Because when Jesus is above all, we don't just think differently, we live differently. And we treat each other differently. So, verse 12, lift your drooping hands, strengthen your weak knees. The writer says that this is what we are to do, and it's bodily language for spiritual reality. He's describing a posture of exhaustion. It's the body language of discouragement. Hands down. Knees weak. You know that moment when you've prayed and prayed and prayed and you're tired? You've stood and stood and stood and your internal world feels shaky. This is a persecuted community. Some have been publicly shamed. Some have lost their property. Some have been imprisoned. In Hebrews 10, the writer has already said that they have joyfully accepted the plundering of their possessions. Would you joyfully accept the plundering of your possessions? That's what he says they've done. They've already paid a cost. And now the pressure continues to mount. And in that pressure, like anyone else, their hands are starting to droop. So the instruction is lift them. Strengthen them. Now, understand what I'm saying. This writer is not just engaging in positive moral thinking. This isn't just positive thinking in a seminar form. It's not pull yourself together. This is the call to re-engage in the race with the strength that only God can provide. And that's very different. And we need a Pentecostal insight into this because it's not optional. God does not merely command these people to strengthen. He does the strengthening in them. He empowers them as well as instructing them. That's because the Spirit of God is in the business of strengthening the weary. He is in the business of renewing the faint-hearted. The Spirit, as I explored in our 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock service, is the Parakletos. He is the one that comes alongside to help. So when the text says lift and strengthen, it assumes that the people of God are not doing this alone. It assumes grace. It assumes presence, God's presence for you and for me. And let me say something pastorally to you, if you will permit me. Sometimes bitterness begins right here, when you are tired and wounded and disappointed. The enemy whispers interpretations that can shape your view of yourself, your church, and others for years. God has forgotten you. No one cares. It has always been like this. You have been faithful, and look where it's gotten you. And if that interpretation or those interpretations are allowed to settle, they become resentment, because entitlement and grace cannot live in the same house. And when you feel entitled to something, you will eventually become bitter about something, because entitlement and bitterness are deeply connected. And we don't explore it pastorally enough. Interpretations that are negative become resentment. Resentment feeds discouragement. Discouragement feeds suspicion. Suspicion feeds pain. Pain feeds blame. And blame births bitterness. So the writer says, lift up your hands. Not because life is easy, but because Jesus is worthy. And because God is at work, even in the hardships of our lives. Then he says, make straight paths for your feet in verse 13, so that what is lame may be healed. Now that is a remarkable instruction. And by the way, these are all from verse 13 all the way through to the commands and instructions around Esau that will be picked up next week. These are all imperatives. That's a command. It's a word that means command. But be careful that when you read the Bible or you hear somebody talking about commands, that you don't place your assumed tone on God's voice. Because often when we hear commands, we think, we need another word. A word that talks about the love of God, the kindness of God, that, and I don't know what it is, that we can put in front of command. Because divine command rarely sounds like God shouting. It more often sounds like God urging. Don't do this, because it's not good for you. It is always rooted in and shaped by love, not impatience or resentment. Now, we don't have many models of such commanding voices in our lives, because we are used to people in authority, parents, teachers, pastors, unfortunately, when they speak with an authoritative voice, sounding angry or impatient or directive in negative ways. But God's voice is never in that category. He never uses his authority to bring us into a place that is further from him. He always uses his authority to draw us toward him. So I don't know whether you want to call them compassionate commands or pastoral commands or relational commands, but we need to put another word in front of the word command to remind yourself that when God commands us to do something in Scripture, he's always doing it because of love and because he's a father that is perfect rather than a father that is imperfect. This remarkable line, make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may be healed, assumes that in the community there are people who are lame, who are injured or vulnerable or at risk. And it gives the community the responsibility to make straight paths, not crooked ones, not chaotic ones, not dangerous ones. This is about creating an environment where the vulnerable are not further harmed. And it was this text that shaped my thinking around how we were to be governed. Rooted in the pastoral instruction of the writer of Hebrews, make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Hear me very, very carefully. Every church is called to be a place where people can limp safely. It isn't a place for the perfect. Every church should be a people where wounded people aren't tripped up, where bruised people aren't pushed out, where fragile people are not mocked. And the aim is not simply don't get worse. The aim is be healed. That is not just practical. It is deeply theological. God's will is not that we simply survive. It is restoration. And yes, I believe in physical healing, but I also believe in inner healing, the healing of memory, the healing of emotions, the healing of relationships, the healing of communities. And what the writer of Hebrews is saying is part of the way God heals people is through the paths that the community make. Isn't that amazing? The way we speak to each other, the way we deal with conflict, the way we confront sin, the way we handle offense, the way we protect the weak. Now, follow the logic of what the writer is saying. If the community makes crooked paths, what are they? Gossip paths, suspicion paths, harshness paths. Then the lame become more wounded. But if the community makes straight paths, what are they? Truthful paths, humble paths, reconciliatory paths, then the lame can be healed. Bitterness creates crooked paths. It makes everything harder to walk. Verse 14, he says, pursue peace and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Two pursuits, both active and both relentless. Pursue peace with a few. That's not what the text says. Pursue peace with everyone. Peace is not passive. The word actually used here, pursue, is athletic. Chase it, hunt it, run after it. That is extraordinary because the recipients are under persecution. You would expect the writer of Hebrews to say, prepare for battle, or get ready for a fight. But he says, pursue peace. Not appeasement, not cowardice, not denial, but do not become a people defined by conflict. Do not become a person consumed by conflict and turmoil. Do you know the breadth with everyone? I mean, whoever wrote this, could you say with almost everyone? Could you give me a get-out clause? I mean, Paul seems to give us a get-out clause, doesn't he? Pursue as far as it depends on you. Thank you, Paul. But this isn't Paul. Pursue peace with everyone. What's that mean? Let's say that you and I enter a conflict and there is no peaceable way out. We may have to respect one another and part ways. We may have to say, look, I agree to disagree. Sometimes you have to have a difficult conversation that says, we're not going to see eye to eye in this. We're going to have to go in separate directions. Some things are so fundamental that you can't stay on the same page with them. But you still pursue peace. You don't approach those conversations ready to kill someone, ready to throw them under a bus. Instead, you become a person that is committed to peace. Peace with everyone must mean, if the word everyone means everyone, it's not very deep exegesis, but it does make sense, right? Peace within your family, peace within the church, peace in households, peace with neighbors, peace even with opponents, and even peace where possible with those who will never agree with you. And that, my dear sister and brother, is a description of kingdom ethics. That is the Sermon on the Mount, lived out in a persecuted context, because Jesus is above all. And we do not mirror the world's hostility. We embody Christ's way. And then we're told, pursue holiness, because without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Now, take note, holiness is not superiority. It is not self-righteousness. It is a set-apart, God-shaped character. And it is pursued. It isn't automatic. It is cultivated. Not earned salvation, but lived out salvation. And again, as a Pentecostal, we've got to remember something here. The Spirit empowers holiness for me. The Spirit sanctifies me. The Spirit does not merely gift me. He forms Christ in me. He is working in me to produce Christ-like character by the Spirit's power. So if we are Spirit-filled and chronically bitter, we have a contradiction. Because the Spirit will always move us toward Christ-likeness. And bitterness is anti-Christ-likeness at the level of our posture, of our attitudes and heart towards other people. And that brings us to the core verse. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and through it many become undefiled. A very complicated sentence. It has three connected concerns. Number one, grace can be missed. Number two, bitterness can spring up. And number three, many can be defiled. Shall we take them one by one? See to it. That's a communal responsibility. It's not a private instruction. This is a community mandate. This is a letter written to a group publicly. They would not have had a copy each. There's an interesting sidebar, by the way, about all of the New Testament letters. I don't know how we would cope with it here in the modern world. You know, you wouldn't get an email saying, Paul has written to us, or whoever wrote this has written to us, here's a copy. They'd say, we've got a letter from Paul. And if you didn't go, you didn't hear it. If you didn't turn up, they didn't come and read it to you. The gathered community was vital for relationships. I wonder how much we would miss if that was the way we functioned. There's something important to say. We're not going to email it. We're not going to print it. We're not going to text it. We're not going to message it. We're going to say it. And if you're not in the gathering, you'll not hear it. That's how the early church was formed. That's why this writer says, do not forsake the gathering together of yourselves as the manner of some is. Because that sense of gathered community was vital to the early church. And I have watched thousands of churches decimated by COVID who did not return to authentic in-person community. And I pray that none of you have settled for Zoom and digital community where physical, real community is possible. Because it is important to be in the same room with another person. I've done some research and read some research for an academic article I was writing about a year ago, in which I'll not bore you, but it goes into the detail of something happens. There's a psychological phenomenon that happens. Let's say the ladies here in the front row and the gents and I were in a room, not this size would work, but in a room together, and we could see each other and talk. There is strong scientific evidence that our neurological pathways begin to mirror one another. So empathy rises because we're in the same room. Now, you would have expected, and they don't know why, there's actual physical change. It's one of these physics. What do you call the physics? You're all looking at me now. Quantum physics. It's one of these quantum physics ideas that they don't really know. They think there's a particle that they can't describe, or there's a substance that makes it happen, but they don't know why. Science doesn't know everything. So you would expect, therefore, that they thought for years it was because you could see each other's face. So you were mimicking each other's emotions or each other's responses without realizing it. But during COVID, they discovered that even when you were in a digital room and you could see each other's faces more clearly, the same phenomena did not happen. So it only happens when you're in the same space. It doesn't happen when you're in a digital space. And they don't know why. So no matter what else, and I love digital community. I really believe in it, and I disciple through it, and I do lots of things in it. I wouldn't write it off at all. I think it's hugely important. But it will never replace being in a room together. Because there's something happens when you're in a room that doesn't happen when you're in a digital room. I don't like the word virtual, but digital connection and physical skin-to-skin or room connection is not the same. And this is written to people together. See to it as a community mandate. Hebrews has been doing this throughout the letter. Chapter 3, verse 12. Take care that none of you. Chapter 3, verse 13. Encourage one another daily. Chapter 10, verse 24. Provoke one another to love. Verse 25, do not neglect meeting together. This whole letter is based on the assumption that we want community and the conviction that we need it. So here again, watch over one another. In other words, perseverance is personal, but it is never private. Holiness is an individual thing, but it is never an isolated thing. Spiritual health is mine, but it is also ours. We share responsibility because a church is not a collection of solo runners. It is a group of people called to run together. And here's a sobering idea. Bitterness is rarely spotted first by a bitter person. It is normally spotted by those around them. That's why the community must see to it. Because we are responsible to guard the fellowship. And that's not control, that is care. That is not suspicion. That is faithful pastoring. I have a friend who pastors a church, a very, very large church in America. And about 10 years ago, he and I were having a conversation because I was dealing with an issue in one of my colleagues and I didn't know what to do. I was finding it quite hard. I don't think I was doing a very good job, actually. It was resolved in the end, thank God. But I said to him, how long do you allow bitterness to rest in your team? He said, 1 week. Now, remember, this is America. I said, what do you mean? He said, if there's a colleague of mine that is spreading poison or spreading bitterness, I meet with them and say, is this what is happening? You have 1 week to fix it or you can find another job. I was like, but what I saw in him was a man that was ruthless about protecting the rest of his colleagues. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. Bitterness is connected to grace. Let me explain. Astonishing language. How can someone in the community fail to obtain grace? God isn't stingy. Grace is not insufficient. They can fail to obtain it because grace can be resisted, neglected, and refused. And Hebrews has already warned us about that. In chapter 2, verse 1, the writer has warned us about drifting. In chapter 3, verse 8, the writer has warned us about hardening our heart. And in chapter 10, verse 39, the writer has warned us about shrinking back. So fail to obtain grace means to step away from the provision that God has made for us in Christ. And then immediately, he says, immediately, this next phrase, that no root of bitterness springs up. So he is linking bitterness to a failure to live in grace. So here's the takeaway for you, particularly those of you that lead small groups or ministries. Bitterness is often a symptom of unexperienced or neglected grace. When grace is received, the heart softens. When grace is resisted, the heart hardens. And bitterness thrives in hardened soil. Let me put it another way. Grace says, I have been forgiven much. Bitterness says, I will not cancel the debt. Grace says, God will judge justly. Bitterness says, I will be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Grace says, I will trust God with my wounds. Bitterness says, I will nurse this wound because it is proof that I was wronged and I am right. And I will not let go of the wound until I am justified. So the pastoral instruction is make sure nobody stands outside of grace. Because outside of grace, bitterness becomes rational and justified and plausible and even preferred. Why does the writer describe it as a root of bitterness? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. Deuteronomy 29:18 talks about roots of bitterness in the Jewish communities. You could read that in your own time. I think there is a link to there. I'm not sure how strong a link. But what is a root of bitterness? Well, what are roots? They're mostly hidden. Not always, but they are mostly hidden. They're invisible. They're underground often, but they feed something. They spread something. And if you live in a house with a garden like mine, they're as stubborn as muck to get rid of. I'm fed up digging up roots in my back garden. I came back from Italy, my wife. I've been away for a few days in France. At the beginning of the week, at the end of last week, I was away. I came back, I cut our grass for the first time. It was very long after the spring break thing. I was trying to do no mow May, but the grass would have been higher than me. So I gave in and cut it. But around the edge of our garden, there's nothing but weeds. And I pulled them all out. And then I came back from France on Friday. My wife had gone to Germany. She's preaching in our German churches today and over the weekend. And I thought, I can't wait to see the garden and see how it's doing. And I'll maybe cut it again before I go away next week. All those jolly roots, all those weeds are back. All of them are back. So yesterday I thought, I'm going to go at them again. And I looked at them and I thought, I don't have the energy. I'm going to make myself a bowl of soup, a cup of tea, and a slice of toast instead. Roots are hidden, they're underground, and they feed and they spread and they are stubborn to get rid of. That tells me that bitterness is rarely sudden. It takes root and grows quietly and silently in the shadow conversations of our lives. In the dark spaces of untruth and accusation and ego and innuendo. And it is destructive. It begins as a seed, a disappointment, an offense, an injustice, a betrayal, a neglect. And if it isn't brought into the light, it becomes a root. Many years ago, when I was a young pastor, I one Sunday morning was standing in church and this lady came up to me and she said, "I am bitterly disappointed in you." And I said, "Why?" She said, "I saw you in town yesterday and you didn't speak to me." And I was flabbergasted. And I said, "Well, I am not bitterly disappointed in you." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I didn't see you. So I didn't speak to you because I didn't see you. But you saw me and didn't speak to me and got bitterly disappointed with me. How can I have been a bitter disappointment to you if I didn't see you in the first place?" And yet that's what happens all the time. I once had an email from somebody that said, "You complimented everybody else, but not me." And I said, "I didn't see you. I didn't realize you were there." But those little seeds can end up being very difficult. And they're very hard to get rid of because they take root. And I could tell you many stories, but I'll tell you one of a situation in my family, not my wife and our children, but in my family, where a mistake, a neglect led to a mistake of affection. And that mistake of affection, not in my life, led to a betrayal. And that betrayal led to a conflict. And that conflict was never resolved. So it became a root of bitterness. And for 50 years, well, 30 years, that root of bitterness remained. So in this situation, there could have been a disagreement about who was washing the dishes. But it always ended up about that betrayal all those years ago. Because it lay unresolved. We could have an argument about going on a picnic. And it always ended up about the root of betrayal. Because the bitterness just took root and got deeper and deeper and deeper, and nobody had the courage to deal with it. Listen, I've been pastoring churches for 40 years. This isn't my first rodeo. And bitterness can take root in people's lives in the most silent of ways. But if you are suffering from it, ask God to dig it out of your soul. Plead with him. Ask for help. Because you can attend church and still have a root of bitterness. You can sing with a root of bitterness. You can serve with a root of bitterness. You can preach with a root of bitterness. But underground, something is growing. And it is not only growing, it is drawing the nutrients that are required for your health, and it is feeding your ill health. Bitterness feeds on rehearsed stories in your head. Let me tell you what they did. Let me remind you what happened. Let me take you back to that moment. Let me replay this wound. And the more you replay it, the deeper the root goes. And then it springs up. And that's when people say, where did that come from? It didn't come from nowhere. It came from the underground issues that are so often present in our lives. But the writer to Hebrews doesn't just say it springs up. He says it springs up and causes trouble. I have seen families destroyed by bitterness, marriages, sibling relationships, businesses, political parties, and nations destroyed by bitterness. This word trouble springs up and causes trouble, carries a sense of disturbance, of upheaval, of agitation. Bitterness never stays contained. It is like bamboo. It grows everywhere. It expresses itself and it comes out as sarcasm, suspicion, constant niggling criticism, withdrawal from healthy community, passive aggression, refusing to reconcile, always needing to be right, recruiting other people into your pain so that they're on your side. I've seen it again and again. And because this is a persecuted community that he's writing to, the stakes are extremely high. External persecution can be survived, but internal bitterness will destroy a church. If the enemy can't stop you from worshiping from the outside, he will try to poison your love from the inside. And Hebrews is saying, don't let it happen. Refuse it. He goes on to say, and through it, many become defiled. Bitterness is hidden. Bitterness disrupts. And bitterness is contagious. That's sobering. He doesn't say a few. He doesn't say some. He says many become defiled. Bitterness is contagious because it spreads as a way of seeing. It spreads like this. You can't trust people here. These leaders always disappoint you. This church will always be like this. God didn't come through then. He'll not come through now. And soon the atmosphere begins to change. A bitter person moves from justifying their suffering privately to create a culture of bitterness. The author says this defiles, it pollutes, it contaminates. That language matters in Hebrews because Hebrews has spent chapters and chapters talking about cleansing, about purity, about the superior sacrifice of Jesus that cleanses the conscience. So to say bitterness defiles is to say that it moves you in the opposite direction to the direction that Christ has purchased for you. Jesus died to cleanse you. Bitterness repollutes your soul. That's serious. Now, let's think about how we apply all of this to us today. We live in a culture that normalizes offense. Outrage is our currency. Grievance has become the identity for many people. People are trained to collect their wrongs and to display them. Some of those wrongs are real. Some wounds are profound. Some injustices are wicked. And we should never minimize pain. We should deal with those things honestly, openly, vulnerably, and with a posture of humility and apology. I grew up in a culture, I don't know if it's the same here in London. I lived in London for 30 years, but I'm from Northern Ireland. I grew up in a culture where the people that were adults in the generation behind me never apologized. They never apologized for anything. It was a sign of weakness to say, I got that wrong. And I was schooled in a discipleship pathway where no pastor ever said, I don't know. I just thought they knew everything. And it didn't matter what you asked them, they knew. And half the time, they were just waffling with confidence. And as a result of their confidence, you believed them, but they weren't telling the truth. They should just have said, I don't know. So there are situations that we should deal with honestly, but it's okay also to say, I don't know. I'm sorry. We got that wrong. I wish we had another way of dealing that. If I could go back and say that again, I wouldn't say it that way. Have you ever met a person and they say something like this to you toward the end, you know, and one part of their conversation? They frighten me. These people frighten me. You say to them, looking back over your long life, is there anything you would change? Not a thing. And I'm like, not a thing. Not a thing. Wouldn't change a conversation. You wouldn't go back and say, could we try that again a different way? I mean, if you say to me, looking back over your life, is there anything that you would change? Yes. There's an awful lot that I would change. It doesn't mean I'm ashamed of my past. It just means that as you get older, maybe you get a bit wiser and you realize the things that you were ready to kill people for when you were 20 were not that important. So I would like to go back. I'd like the 55-year-old Malcolm to go back to the 17-year-old Malcolm and say, relax. Just say you don't know. Apologize. Don't be afraid not to have all the answers. I wish we were learning to become more like that. Not, I don't mean KT, I mean just Christians. Hebrews is warning, the writer is warning the people that are receiving this letter, do not let your pain become your poison. There's a difference between an honest lament and a bitter complaint, between seeking justice and nursing vengeance, and between setting boundaries and harboring hatred. And the reason this matters is because the church has a calling under pressure to embody the life of the kingdom. We are a people who overcome evil with good. We are a people who bless those who persecute us. We are a people who pursue peace and holiness. Bitterness can often feel like strength, like protection. I won't be fooled again. But it is not strength. It is bondage. It is drinking poison and hoping that someone else will suffer. And the Spirit of God doesn't want you to live bound. He wants you to live healed. That's why Hebrews 12:13 says, so that it may be healed. God's aim is not just endurance, it is healing. And this is where we come to the wonderful, beautiful, above all, Jesus. Because Jesus' answer to bitterness helps us with our answer to bitterness. We aren't called to try to be nicer. We aren't called simply to move on. We are called to look to Jesus. Jesus reveals to us the heart of God, you see. Bitterness says God is distant. But Hebrews says that God has spoken to us decisively in these last days through his Son. In chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, it says to us he is the exact imprint of God's being and the very representation of his nature. If you want to know God's heart toward you in suffering, don't look at other people, look at Jesus. Jesus is our sympathetic high priest, able to sympathize with our weaknesses, Hebrews says in chapter 4, verse 15. How come he knew betrayal and injustice and suffering, but never became bitter? If anyone could say no one understands, Jesus could say no one understands. But Hebrews says there is someone who understands. Because it happened to him. Jesus understands. And that is why we can approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in time of need. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. Grace is not a theory. Grace is help. Grace is power. And grace is here in Jesus. Thirdly, his sacrifice cancels the debt-collecting attitude in our lives. Bitterness keeps accounts. It keeps ledgers. It relives the offense again and again in its head. But Hebrews says Jesus offered himself once and for all. Chapter 10, verse 10, he has dealt not with my sin only, but with the sin of the whole world. He has secured justice. He has opened a way to God. And if that is true, then I am released from playing the God card in my relationships. I can forgive, not because the offense is small, but because Christ is great. And fourthly, he has run this race ahead of us. Earlier in this chapter, we've been reminded that Jesus is the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. He ran the road of hostility and did not become bitter. He endured the cross and despised its shame and trusted his Father rather than rejecting him. And the Spirit who strengthened him strengthens us. So the supremacy of Jesus, the above allness of Jesus, is not just doctrinal, it is medicinal. It heals. It liberates. It sets the heart free. How do I know? Because he's done it in me. And I'm looking around this room and he's done it in you. 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 And in you. And in you. And in you. And I could go around this room. This is the medicine that he has applied to our souls. There is a balm in Gilead. I don't need to live with the bitterness of a life that I would not have chosen. The things that were said or done to me are God's to bring healing, not mine to work out. I don't need to have an answer to every issue or a solution to every problem. I don't need to be justified. I don't need to win the argument. Because I have Jesus, and he has me. Next week, Pastor Scott will be talking about Esau, someone else who teaches us lessons. I'm not going to say much about him at all, not Pastor Scott, Esau, because I don't want to steal his thunder. But in him, Hebrews warns us against trading our long-term spiritual inheritance for short-term emotional satisfaction. Bitterness can feel satisfying in the moment, but in the long term, it leaves us with nothing. So what do? We bring the root into the light. We tell the truth. We receive the grace of God. Have mercy on me, Jesus. Cleanse my heart. We choose the straight path. Maybe this is the hard bit. Make the phone call. Have the conversation. Refuse gossip disguised as concern. Talk to somebody who can make a difference about your situation. Take the path that leads to healing. Not every relationship is reconciled in the same way. There are some in my life that I haven't been able to do anything about because reconciliation involves two sides. It doesn't matter how willing you are to be reconciled to somebody. If they are not safe, or if they are not willing to acknowledge their guilt or take responsibility for their actions, you have to learn to leave it and protect yourself. But I have learned that when you release bitterness, you drop the chain. If somebody else carries that for the rest of their lives, that is not your responsibility. Bitterness is never your calling. Pursue peace and holiness. Let God be what God is. Let him touch you. Let him minister to you. And ask the Holy Spirit for power and for healing. My life is a life in which I have experienced that the Holy Spirit can remove the sting of trauma at the deepest level, break the power of offense, restore tenderness, put love back into a hard heart, and give emotional, spiritual capacity to bless people that have hurt you. This is not hype. This is my lived experience. The sanctifying work of the Spirit that sets you free. Don't let what happens to you become what happens to other people. Let it end with you. Lift your drooping hands. Strengthen your weak knees. Make straight paths. Pursue peace and holiness. And see to it together that no root of bitterness is allowed to grow, because it causes trouble and defiles many. And here is the gospel hope. Jesus is above all. Above your pain, above your offense, above the injustice, above the betrayal, above the wound. He is the superior son, the sympathetic priest, the perfect sacrifice, the pioneer of our faith. So we do not become hardened. We become holy. We do not become bitter. We receive grace. Amen.